Welcome to the HC Insider Podcast, a podcast dedicated to the commodities sector and the people within it. I'm your host, Paul Chapman.
Today we're talking dry freight trading and building a picture up of what it is, but also how it's been changed by deglobalization, the energy transition, and digitization, and how that has created enormous opportunities for organizations, has created convergence within the market, and changing the nature of the talent required. We'll also talk about how this market in particular offers the potential to transform freight trading desks, as well as the overall opportunity. Our guest is Mads Frank Markussen. Mads Frank is the head of research and market intelligence at the European shipowner and freight trader Navi Merchants, and has worked as a freight trader in both Denmark and Switzerland. As always, you can really support the show by leaving us a positive review on the platform you're listening on, particularly a written review on Apple or a show comment on Spotify. It really helps expand the audience and therefore continue to allow us to get great guests on. And as always, I hope you enjoy the episode. Mads Frank, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Paul.
So I'm looking forward to this discussion. We are talking dry freight, a bit of a 101 on what is it, how does it work, how does it trade, and then talking about how digitization and technology is changing the opportunity landscape for all of the participants, and even moving on to what AI could mean. But let's start at the beginning. What do we mean by dry freight?
Dry freight are describing the type of goods you move on ships where the commodity is dry. Oil, by nature, is wet. So what is dry is something like wheat, corn, coal, iron ore, fertilizer. This means you can store it in a warehouse, you can close the door, super. It can lie on the ground, you can pick it up with a forklift, etc.
First, I'd like to get some sense of the names and types of the ships involved in this. And then secondly, can you give us some sense of scale of this market, you know, in comparison to, say, the wet freight market?
I can definitely start by describing the ship types. You have everything from vessels that can carry 400,000 tons of iron ore that goes only between Brazil and China, huge mega constructions that are maybe 300-400 meters long, down to very small ships here in Europe that carry 500 tons between small local ports, and the captain, he actually lives on board with his wife. So shipping is many things. We'll be focused on the larger segments for this piece, because that's what's interesting. That's what there is a business in. If we look at how big is the market, it's hard to say, because a lot of this stuff goes outside of exchanges. It goes on contracts between people in all kinds of jurisdictions all over the world. There is, of course, a financial side to trading freight via exchanges for like derivatives and stuff, but that is still a relatively small part of the overall trade compared to, let's say, grain, where I heard that in Chicago, something like 94% of all futures are traded by machines financially. The wheat market and the corn market in the physical nature is much smaller than the financial side. In the freight markets, I would argue cash markets are bigger and more important.
Yeah.
Why are they bigger? Why are they more important? Well, because you cannot really take delivery of a ship via a future. You can take delivery of a ship if you agreed with a ship owner, but that means you need to have a relationship with him. He needs to trust you. After all, it's a $30 million asset that you are renting from him.
We're going to come on to FFAs and unpick that a little bit. Okay, so just for edification, what are the main types of ships that we're talking about here, the Panamaxes and Cape sizes and so forth?
The main types of ships we're talking about here is the largest size are called these Valemaxes. They go from Brazil to China. Then you have Cape size, carry around 150,000 tons. They are also very active on the financial sides in the FFAs. The class smaller than that is called baby capes, around 110,000 tons. Then you have the Panamax, or Kamsarmax, as the modern Panamaxes are called. They are around 75,000 to 82,000 tons. You go further down, you have Supramax at 58,000 tons, and then Handysize at 38. Anything smaller than that, it's hard to put a name on it, because then they start to become very versatile. because they can also carry windmills, they can also carry project cargo, and it's still shipping, it's very much shipping, but it's less clear-cut what types of vessels there are.
Great. Moving toward the participants, there's three key participants. Can you give us an outline of them, and in particular what their goals are and kind of how they view trading?
There are three major categories of participants. There are obviously the ones selling freight, that is the ship owners. They have an asset, they need something to sail with. Then on the other side, you have the freight buyers, they're called charterers. And then in the middle, you have traders, like in any market. But in shipping, we call them operators. I think this is very similar to many other markets. But what maybe is a little bit different in freight market is there's a very big blend of various types of operations. Someone might own, you know, a few ships, but they might have a big trading outfit on top. But they also have a trading arm they support. I think if you look at the wet side, on the oil side, I think Trafigura is a good example of someone who does everything and is in every part of the value chain. In dry bulk, this also exists. But I think that how the market is structured is maybe a bit more clear-cut. Traditionally, you have a lot of ship owners in a place like Greece, Denmark, where I'm from, Germany, also China, Japan, lots of sellers. Now, you also have some freight buyers. They are generally the traders or the very big commodity companies. They tend to be located at the international trading hubs, New York, London, Singapore, Geneva. And then you have all these in-between traders or operators, which are also, some are located in, let's say, Denmark or Geneva, but some are also located in Dubai because of tax reasons, because of various different reasons. And I think, looking at where it's going, it's definitely going towards a sort of consolidation among these types, that what you're seeing now in oil trading with a Trafigura doing everything, you will also start seeing that in dry bulk.
Okay, well, I want to understand that. So, but just traditionally, so you have these owners, they own these assets that are 20, 30 years in use. You know, what are their goals and how do they view the world?
The beautiful thing about ship owners is they view the world uniquely in their own way. If we try to generalize them, I would say there are the traditional asset players who speculate in asset values. They try to buy cheap, sell high. What happens in between when they have to trade the vessel is sort of like something happening while they're waiting to sell. Then you had another type of shipping investors who are looking at a bit more, okay, I need this asset because I need to run a company and I need to have access to some transportation. But you could say whether you own a ship in order to buy cheap, sell high, or you do it to run it for a period of time as part of your value chain, you're still looking to extract the maximum amount of value from whatever you're doing. And I think what categorizes freight or shipping market is that, of course, you also have some buyers on the other end who wants to buy as cheap as possible. But the difference between, let's say, freight markets and some other markets is that the goods that the ship owners have are inelastic. If you have 60,000 tons of soybeans, which you're looking to move from, let's say, Brazil to China, there's really no alternative. Containers, not an alternative. You know, it's not like they can buy soybeans from nearby markets in Korea, Japan. So you have to pay whatever it is. However, it's also worth keeping in mind, and this is a fact I haven't been able to find on Google. It's something I heard a while back, and I still think it holds true. The freight of transporting on truck from Brazil fields to the ports in Brazil is larger and more costly than the freight of transporting from the ports of Santos or Paranaguá in Brazil all the way with ship to China.
Yeah, I've heard similar from our Brazilian clients, and part of that is the state of the roads and the wear and tear on the trucks, but also the province, the various states and their tax issues and so forth. But that inelasticity, and let's just get this right now, that also creates quite a unique market in the wild swings, right? So essentially, if two ships turn up, you know, at the same port empty, ship rates can drop dramatically. And if no ships turn up, they can go wildly high. Can you give us some sense of how that inelasticity plays in there? And then I want to move to the charters.
Exactly. It's a very good example because, again, you need to employ your ship. I think if we look at this Baltimore Bridge disaster, which happened a month ago now, you took something around, I think it was 1.5% or 2% of Atlantic demand for ships out of the market, and global prices fell from $36,000 to $18,000 a day for the ship type called Capesize. So the marginal extra demand or the marginal extra supply can mean the world in difference on price development.
Yeah. Okay, so because we're going to paint this picture of also this consolidation, but historically you then had this separate group, which were the charterers, who were essentially the buyers of the freight, who were servicing the needs of the trading houses, the traders. How was it historically structured? Would it be that the traders would then phone up a particular broker who would then interact with the pool operator, the charterers, to then sort that ship?
Historically, it's been very much based on relationship. If you knew someone and he worked in shipping, you gave him a call, he would find a ship owner and he would collect the commission. As times developed, and I would say probably more in the, let's say, late 90s, start zeros, when the whole commodity industry was growing very fast due to China, but also due to advancements in technology, people started professionalizing. They started organizing teams around saying, okay, you are team South America, you three look after all flows in and out of South America. Because now you needed to have expertise in every region. Before, things were a bit slower. You were actually telexing people back in the 80s. So you could be one, two guys who was kind of like holding the fort, making everything go around. But now suddenly things started to become more financialized. The money got bigger. The volumes got bigger. So now you needed dedicated teams to take care of, yeah, a specialist role.
And this would be in any given trading house, you would have a team of charterers who would be transacting via brokers, just to get that right, right? There's no, there wasn't sort of a central exchange or anything.
Yeah, they were, yeah. Brokers makes the world go round, especially in freight markets. You have generally a setup where you have, let's say, let's take Geneva and agricultural commodities, because that's what I'm familiar with. You have something like, let's say, 4, 5, 6 major grain freight buyers, but you have a whole forest of brokers serving them. But these guys, they know it's not enough to be close to your customer. You also need to be close to the sellers. So they set up offices in, let's say, Greece or Denmark, where there's a lot of supply. And then they co-broke. So each broker has like a specialty. One is close to the cargo customer, the other is close to the owner. Because what happens in freight markets, and I could imagine it was similar in other markets, but it's very prevalent in freight markets, is when markets are rising, ship owners are king of the castle. When markets go down, the freight buyers are king of the castle. So you need these guys in between to manage this, let's say, and you owe me one from last time, now I owe you one, to make things go around.
Yeah, which is kind of, I don't know whether this is a fair comment, but it's quite far behind, as you alluded to earlier, more financialized markets, right? Given the importance of brokers in this space, perhaps a lack of transparency, it's based on relationships and so forth, which I guess is going to be important for later in the story. Okay, so then you've got the traders, and essentially what you alluded to as well was the fact that the traders started saying, hang on a minute, why don't we also start participating in these freight markets and turn, you know, have our own, not only our own chartering teams, but also our own traders sat around freight and start owning our own ships.
Yeah, exactly.
And this is where kind of this time charter versus just a voyage charter comes in. Can you just help us understand that?
Yeah, definitely. So as trading houses grow more smart, as they need to be more on top of the game, as they need to, you know, deliver more value to the customers, they start thinking outside of the box. And one thing is to buy freight from one port to one port somewhere in the world and kind of say, that was it, I bought it, now I'm out of it. They also start thinking, what if I rent my own ship? Then I can load wherever in this region and redeliver wherever in this region. This is very, let's say, practical when you are at grain house, you have a lot of volume out of South America. You're not quite sure which port in Brazil or Argentina you're going to ship out of. Maybe you have different contracts. You also have different buyers in both Algeria, Spain, Italy, France. And the ship owner, as long as he gets paid, you can kind of redeliver him anywhere, because he's calculating, what does it cost for me to sail to my next employment? And whether you're in southern Spain, Algeria, Morocco, it's sort of the same distance. So now suddenly, if you are a prudent charter, you have a lot of flexibility on your books. It also means a different type of risk, but you have more flexibility. And if you're a very large commodity company that has a lot of value,
Yeah, this is this idea that, you know, if you are time chartering the ship, you don't have to have that specific port. It's very complex trying to get the various hedges on that you would need if you don't necessarily know the final destination. So let's bring in freight forward agreements. These are the primary derivative that all participants can use to hedge their exposure or indeed trade. Can you give us some sense of what they are? And there's a uniqueness to them in the fact that they don't settle against a physical product.
Correct. Freight forward agreements are cleared products that trade. They are in dollar per day. So they follow a physical index of 10 routes in the world, which get averaged out. So if you have a ship in Asia, if you have a ship in Brazil, if you have a ship in anywhere in the world, and on average, you should do as well as the index. Now, what's interesting about the mechanism behind them is it's a swap. So you don't get delivered something. So if you bought FFA as a hedge and FFA skyrockets, you still have to go out and buy physical freight if you're short physical freight. And that is more difficult than it sounds. Maybe the global flat price FFA is going to go up, but the where it goes up can be very dislocated. Maybe the routes out in China go up 10%, but the routes in Brazil goes up 50%. That equates to a 30% on average increase. But if you are a charter out of Brazil, this basis risk is more, let's say, more violent to you than it is if you were in Brazil. Yeah, I think it's important to stress that unlike a future, this doesn't converge with physical markets. You cannot force delivery of a ship. So your basis risk is really different. I haven't done any studies on it. There haven't been done any studies of it that I know. But if I had to guess, I think that the basis risk of shipping soybeans out of Brazil on a freight basis is larger than the basis risk for, let's say, wheat versus the Matif, because those two converge. If you're shipping grains out of France and you're hedging yourself with the Matif, they converge at some point. The freight forward agreements doesn't necessarily converge with the Brazilian market. It converges on a global basis. But what happens if Brazil goes up 30% and China goes down 30%? Then your hedges have done nothing. So this is a very big part of being a freight trader, is managing that risk.
I mean, they're relatively new, aren't they, FFAs? They were coming out when I started my career at HC, nearly 20 years ago. Is there just sort of a lack of granularity of the different indexes you can do a swap against, and people are trying to bring out more various types of contracts and regions to sort of try and even that basis risk out? Or, how is that FFA market developing? And indeed, are all of those operators, those charterers and those traders, are they all sophisticated enough now to be using FFAs?
I think that the world has come a long way in 20 years, but I don't think it has come as far as one would suspect. The main people buying and selling FFAs 20 years ago in the cash markets were the big commodity traders, because they were cleared already. They were already on the exchanges. They knew how these things worked. The ship owners in Greece or Denmark or whatever, they didn't see the need for it, because they knew, or they accepted that their business was, well, 5 years in a row, we're sort of going to break even, maybe lose a little bit of money. And on the sixth year, it's going to be amazing, because freight is inelastic. Now, of course, more people in Denmark and Greece have started looking at FFA. You have also a fairly large amount of hedge funds moving into it, using it as a proxy hedge for inflation and whatnot. But I think because it is so violent and because it's so, let's say, you cover the whole world when you buy a product, it's also a little bit difficult. Because again, if you have these large mega ships traveling from China to Brazil and back again, or from Japan to the US, you are basically a global worldwide trader. But if you have a smaller fleet, you primarily trade around Europe or maybe a bit to the USA, you're only covering 25% of the world in your trading. And then starting to hedge yourself with something where you have 75% of the risk, which doesn't really apply to your book, is, well, risky. And I think as time goes on, ship owners become bigger, the world become more globalized, all these kind of things, more and more people will come on and have come on, but it's still something that is not common practice among all shipping companies.
The HC Insider podcast is brought to you by HC Group, a retained search, intelligence and advisory firm focused solely on the global energy and commodity sector. With 6 locations across Asia, Europe and the Americas and over 50 consultants. To find out more, go to our website, hcgroup.global. There, you can also sign up for our HC Insider content for more interviews and white papers on relevant trends and talent impacts in the commodities world.
Okay, well, that brings us nicely to today. Can you give us some sense of the market, kind of the macro trends that are going on in dry freight?
One of the most clear mega trends is that freight trading have become more financialized. There is a drive towards a lot of the trading companies and a lot of the ship owners to start being traders themselves. As they run larger and larger books, they need to be able to lay off that risk. Having metrics such as value at risk also means that the way you can actually lay off this risk is to the financial market. If your value at risk suddenly starts blinking, it's very hard to call up a ship owner. It's very hard to get on a contract for carriage of whatever commodity. It's much easier to call up a financial broker and get the financial hedge. Again, it's not a perfect hedge, but you can get it and you can get it fast. I think also if you're looking at the owning side, I think a mega trend is that ship owners are becoming larger. They're becoming larger for two reasons. You need to be big in order to get cheap capital and to able to comply with all the financial stuff you need to put together in order to actually buy ships. Because after all, a ship costs somewhere between $20 to $100 million per ship. So if you're out buying 10 ships, you need a lot of cash. The second thing is that there's a lot of regulation in ESG. And if you have a few ships, the overheads just explode on a per ship basis. So you cannot really be competitive. I think if we look at the freight traders that sort of is in the middle of all this, it's sort of the same. They need to be aware of all this regulation. They need to be on top of all of it. They need to offer solutions to their customers for these things. So the overheads are quite big, which means you need a fairly big trading outfit. That leads us to the sellers, which the same dynamics apply, but with a small footnote. And that is that due to the, let's say, geopolitical world we live in today with a lot of disruption, a lot of change. If we look at the last 10 years, we have a relatively stable world onto COVID. We have two crazy years during COVID. And then after COVID, we had the war in Ukraine. Now we have, you know, who knows what comes next if, let's say, Donald Trump gets elected. So suddenly you have a world that's a lot more uncertain. That means that a lot of the people who used to just go about the world, not thinking a lot, selling FOB to whatever trader offered them the best price, are now being forced to think, okay, can I really sell to these guys? Are they shipping it to Iran? Okay, if you're a Ukrainian FOB seller, okay, what do I do now? I cannot interact with any of these guys because my country is in a war zone. So we're seeing, at least on the grain side, a lot of commodity sellers, traditionally FOB sellers, entering the market, trying to do freight themselves, trying to be more educated. I think if you look at oil trading, here it's very extreme. You have a whole shadow fleet servicing Russia. So the world has gone, you know, gone from relatively stable, globalized, where it was about being the best at math. Now it's come back to a world where you really have to factor in known unknowns. You have to factor in, okay, what are the gray swans here? What happens if the Houthis win the war in Yemen and that the Suez Strait actually closes for a prolonged period of time? And this is difficult. And this is very different to manage. Because if I'm being asked to quote a price, what are the price of 20% chance that the Houthis will win a war down in the Red Sea? Like, it's very, very difficult. I can, of course, calculate conservatively, give you some freight rates, these kind of things. But then you will most likely lose out to the guy who's willing to take the chance. And 8 out of 10 times he wins, you're kind of stuck as a commodity trader with an annoying freight guy who doesn't want to take any risk. And these 2 times it blows out, you'll be like, okay, that was prudent enough. Another mega trend that comes on top of all of this is also the rising energy crisis, prices and the energy transition. Basically, it means that transport are more expensive. It also means, maybe not today, but tomorrow when the first generation of new fuel ships arrive, that suddenly you don't have vessels that sail anywhere and can put on any fuel in the world. You would have ships who are confined to certain trade lanes. You will have ships who have certain fuel needs and therefore need to go some certain places. All of these factors lead into a world that's more volatile, which is great for freight traders, but it also makes it difficult for commodity traders to put things together. Yeah, and I think, again, if summing all this up, what does it mean for the people outside of freight industry and inside? It means that bigger companies need to become bigger to manage these things. And that also means they will become more financialized.
Yeah, I like the phrase gray swans. Very good. I'll steal that one and use it in future. But it's obviously an increasingly complex world that's driving that consolidation, that's driving the need to manage risk. It's also, as you say, these are also long-term assets for the owners as well, who are having to make big bets on what the future might require from an energy transition, all of which ultimately, as you say, means a more restricted world and costs go up.
And it is difficult. It is difficult because where do you place your money? And right now, one thing is that you maybe want to take a bet on methanol, or you want to take a bet on, let's say, traditional fuel, but that's not the same as your bank want to do. And it also depends, are you a bank in Denmark, or you're looking for a bank in China? You know, it's suddenly a very, very complex world, whereas before, you could call up a guy in Greece, you call up a guy in Japan, you could call up China's national bank. You get a quote for what does it cost, what is the cost of capital, what can we do, different structures. And you could actually compare apples with apples and you could sleep fairly well at night. But these days, you have to really think in alternative scenarios. Because suddenly you also have, for example, the EU, which I think is giving funding to build vessels with European shipyards, giving incentives for people to have flags that are European and not just taking the vessels and putting them into some ship register in Panama or somewhere. So suddenly there's a lot more geopolitical risk and a lot more scenario planning involved. And this is even before the ship hits the water.
I guess one unintended consequence of all this is that you're better off delaying decisions around future investment. So are we seeing the fleet just getting older and therefore more riskier?
Yes, definitely. I think more riskier is a big word. Of course, there's an element of it. But I think a word I would rather use is more inefficient. Because after all, especially on dry bulk, these ships are very simple. Ships built 10 years ago, they are very huge. But it's in essence a lot of steel with an engine. And we've been building vessels with steel engines for 100 years. So these vessels can probably sail for 40 years. Now, in general, if we say more than 20, 25 years in, let's say, the Western Hemisphere, it's no go. Then we send them to Asia. They have a bit more leniency. At some point, they probably disappear into some sort of Chinese coastal trade. But these ships are built to last. I think the oldest ship I can find on my radar program to look at all ships in the world is 99 years old and sails between Turkey and Romania.
Wow. Okay, so we've got two more pieces to get in. One is I want to talk talent briefly, but then we're going to talk about technology, information, digitization, and how that could solve some of these complexities and also change the competitive landscape. Let's just talk talent for a moment because we spoke about it prior to our planning for this. All of this, so you've got consolidation, which typically means fewer seats, but ultimately you've got more risk and more complexity coming from your freight exposure. And that means you do need more talent to be able to manage that. And you've got this sort of coalescence of the traders themselves building, and HC has been a big part of this over the last 15 years, actually, on both the wet and the dry side, including Traffic Eurosdesk. All of that means that more people, you know, want teams that can manage this risk. And I know from personal experience, freight trading searches are challenging just because of the paucity of talent. Can you just give us some sense of that, the competition for talent and why that is?
I think there are, let's say, many reasons why, but I think my best guess is it's a little bit of a boom and bust market. So when the years are horrible, there's no money to invest in talent. People would rather like, no, we wait, we'll stick with what we got. And when years are good, people are like, we need to hire. We cannot find anyone. But let's look at it next year. That's sort of the, let's say, easy explanation. I think there is a second explanation, which is shipping in general is a very craftsmanship job. You need to know a lot of weird facts. You need to know a lot of weird things around the world, which doesn't really apply to anywhere else outside of shipping. You need to know about what is the salinity of various types of water, what is the tropical seasons of Africa. And all this stuff, you only really learn it by doing. It's hard to read a book. It's not like you can sit and backtest trading strategies, because again, it's a global world, there's 12,000 ships sailing, but you only have something like, 25 routes that are indexed. So the talent pool comes from bottom up. It's ship agents, it's young guys who gets a spot next to someone. It's not really through, let's say, universities where you study a master's in, let's say, statistics and AI, and then you go in. And now suddenly we have a world where the world fleet has over the last, 15 years, doubled. But I don't think the amount of people have doubled. There's been an increased efficiency by digital tools. There's been increased efficiency by the people working there. But the amount of people being educated has not doubled, so to say. So I agree, there is clearly a lack of freight traders out there. We also see it in my company when we're out searching. Because you need not only people who are intelligent, but you also need people who are cultural fit. And you also need people who has a good conscience, you know, people who will follow up, people who are there for the best interest of the company. All these kind of things need to align. And it's difficult.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because as you say, the sort of the historical route to freight trading was probably, I mean, frankly, you were probably born into a family that was involved in the shipping industry to start with. But you would have spent, you know, friends of mine, you know, they spent time on ships, right? And as you say, it is that sort of apprentice style background. But now, you know, in order to participate in these markets, you also need to be a great mathematician. You also need to be a technologist, you know, and those two things aren't necessarily entwined in the same background. So it is that's a story writ large across commodities as well. The sort of that you need that deep physical expertise, and that often means coming up through operations or shipping or whatever it might be. But now you need individuals who also have this, you know, deep mathematical expertise, that commerciality, of course, cultural fit. And yeah, it's a challenge to square that circle.
Yeah, and I think also we are in a special moment of time where these two things are converging. I think if you look back 10 years ago, craftsmanship was more important. I think now you definitely, you know, you have both need for both things, but they're kind of in specialized roles in the company. I think in the future, you would probably see more people with a bachelor or master's degree getting into shipping. I think you will see the craftsmanship becoming less important for something like, let's say, the larger ship types, where there's been a lot of standardization by, the Global Ship Owners Association around contracts, these kind of things. I know from my friends in the tanker shipping that essentially you just negotiate five numbers, and then the rest of the contract, management have sort of decided, well, if we are going to fix with Shell this year, this is the base contract we use for all our fixtures with Shell. So maybe they do 200 fixtures a year with Shell, but you only actually negotiate five numbers for that contract, because the rest has been pre-negotiated by management. I'm not saying that dry bulk is heading the same direction. There's still a lot of niche trades. There's still smaller ship sizes, all of that. But standardization is coming. Not within the next 2-3 years, but within the next, let's say, 5-10 years.
Yeah. And it's that standardization and all of the things that you've very clearly set out for us, that financialization, that sort of increasing coalescence of the different participants and the transparency that can bring, that and I guess the thrust of this episode, finally getting to it, is that technology, the information, the application potentially of AI technologies could transform this sector. And you argue that there's some unique attributes in shipping, in dry bulk shipping, that mean that you can start really using an algorithm to solve these challenging problems and opportunities.
Yes, definitely. Before I get to that, there's still on the talent side, I would say it's hard to know what is a good trader before he starts trading. You know, it's not like you can test a guy and say, ah, this guy, he has an IQ of 120. He went to a fine school. He must become a super trader. It's something that needs to be bred in people. It's something that needs to be tested. Some people have it and some people get it by training at it. And yeah. I think, you know, whether you are coming from a traditional shipping background, whether from a master's degree, whether you are very into tech and AI, you still have to ask yourself a few fundamental questions every day. Okay, you come into the office. What do I want to buy and sell? What does my balance sheet tell me? What have changed? What is going to change? Are there any risk I'm taking on here that I don't really like, that I shouldn't, you know, put on my books? What will happen to the spreads, the premiums, the energy complex, etc.? These questions are universal. And I think it's the same. You mentioned it a bit on other commodities. I imagine if you are an energy trader, if you are a wheat trader, it's the same. And it's hard to say who turns out to be the good trader in any market before they actually started trading.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, it's a real challenge. And part of that is that intangible of risk appetite, right? How well someone sleeps at night with, you know, their career on the line. But let's tackle this technology piece in the time we've got left. So I laid it
out.
Yeah,
and I think this is a good bridge into the technology, because I think AI, or let's say more advanced mathematics, advanced machine learning, are at a point where it can really help people working in freight markets. It's been slowly coming. It's taking a bit of time to get its footing for the, let's say, the vendors to get their value propositions right. But we're starting to get there. I know, for example, that Cargill, they develop market algorithm to try and predict stuff, which they use as decision support. It's still a physical market. You still trade via brokers. But I can see, you know, how it's coming. Cargill is probably the big and the best and the biggest. So that they're leading this is no surprise. But now various commercial vendors are building solutions to customers to predict various things. I think that the best algorithms built so far is not market algorithms. They are algorithms for prediction of fuel consumption, prediction of weather, prediction of lost time in ports, all these kind of elements that goes into the computation of a freight rate, because these problems are bound in physics and the real world, so to say. Like the sun will still set at a certain time, and if it rains here, then, you know, it's good likelihood that next year, same time, it's going to rain as well. It's not like the winter in Denmark is suddenly going to be 30 degrees. It's still going to be winter. But that being said, the AI algorithms is coming. Now, one of the things that I have a bit of insight on that I don't think a lot of people have in the freight market is, how do you combine all of this? Because I build an algorithm that takes all of this and spits out dollar per ton freight rates. Again, some part of it, AI was very good at solving. Some of it is not super good at solving. So you still have this hybrid of man and machine. And I think if I have to make an analogy of, you know, what is it that we have been successful with? It is the times where we're taking like a chess approach. You take Deep Blue plus Kasparov. They work together to play chess. Man versus machine, it's hard to, you know, make it work, because there will be times where the machine breaks down because of the inelastic nature of freight markets. Again, I think if you had a school assignment and I told you a vessel is going to hit a bridge in Baltimore, 2% of world demand will go down, the price is $36,000, what will happen to price? I think very few would say, well, it's going to go down by 50%. But this is what happens in shipping. And I think the models trying to predict freight markets on such an accurate basis is going to struggle. But if you have a machine or have a human operator saying, hey, I know what's going to happen. I've seen this before. 2% is actually a lot in this market, especially in this place, because it's a whatever key point for a certain trade. Then you can probably get a better estimate than if it was a machine doing it alone.
This is kind of the story that's playing out a little bit. And, you know, AI, there's a lot of, as we discussed, right, there's a lot of sort of hype about it, and what is a lot of what people are calling AI isn't. But certainly this idea that actually, if all markets are operating normally, you've got quite a set of parameters there in shipping that you can solve for, right? Port depth.
Yeah, definitely. If the world was normal, if the world was globalized, if there was no trade wars, if there were no pirates or Houthis, it would be fairly straightforward. There would still be some operational risk, a little bit of basis risk, but it would be fairly manageable. But given the geopolitical risk, given the probabilities you have to assign to various things, it gets very difficult.
Well, and that's where you need the human who comes, we come back full circle. You need the superhuman, he or she, that, you know, knows the craftsmanship, knows the, has the masters in computer science and mathematics, but also has the relationships, because that's ultimately what it's about, and the experience to be able to, when the issue, the event happens, to solve for it as well, right? So I think, and I've had this discussion with quite a few people, especially last week at the FT Commodities Conference, where it's kind of like the role of trader could be shifting over the long term away from kind of the day-to-day risk execution to essentially that sort of event management and of capitalizing on events, but also solving them through, you know, those relationships and the experience that they have.
I think that's a very fair point, especially in companies that are very value chain driven, where they set up, okay, we own origination in South America, we ship it on our own ship or our own freight department to some crushing plane somewhere, and then we drive some downstream products. Here you have a captive flow. You have maybe 10 of these plants all over the world. And then as you say, well, these things are going to flow. Things are going to sort themselves out. Now I need to find these 3 times a year when things are going to go bonkers, and then I'm going to trade it. And I think that for a lot of the other stuff in between, you will either get software or you will get some sort of helpers to sit and just manage these like smaller pieces. And then you would, as let's say a super trader, sit and monitor that. I think as a parallel, if you look at, let's say, freight operations today, you have software for monitoring the fuel. You have software for monitoring the arrival of the vessel, software for the weather, software for calculating how much time in port. So you actually have also people paying the money for the port for you. So what you sit and do is you sit and validate, you make sure that things add up, and you always think, if something is going to go wrong, where is it going to go wrong? It's not like you sit and actually calculate how much cargo I'm going to take on this ship or what route I'm going to sail. This the computer does for you, but you have to sit and constantly monitor. And I think for some commodity flows, this is going to be still the case. I think for others, let's say this wheat cases I mentioned for the people in Ukraine, they need to reinvent. They need to start trading because now suddenly they don't have an outlet. It's not like the Bungie and the Cargill and the Louis Dreyfus is going to bid them something for delivery. They sit there and they have to find out, what is the market? How can I deliver it? What does insurance look like for this type of trip? What are my risks? Okay, what if I sell CFR and my terminal gets bombed? Can I then buy CFR, FOB somewhere else in the world? And this is, you know, a different type of game. But in the end, they still need a lot of data and they still need a lot of tools to be able to make those decisions.
Let's wrap it up by weaving in, you've already mentioned what you're working on. You know, who are Navi Merchants and what is it you're doing there for that, I guess, is at the vanguard of this change?
I think that Navi Merchants is not so interesting in this context. It's a traditional ship owner, it's a freight trader, but it's not really what's, let's say, sets me apart in this conversation, because I think there's many people working in ship owners. What's really interesting and the reason why, let's say, I'm here today is this thing we built in the CM Navigator, where we calculate freight rates for all routes in the agri markets. So we take all theoretical combination of wheat ports from, even if it's from Ukraine and Russia and whatnot, and calculate all theoretical destinations. We also do it on corn and soybeans and other agricultural commodities. So we land at something like 250,000 different freight rates calculated every day. Now, if we add that on top of our FOB prices, then we land at something like 16 million combinations for how commodities are priced into various places. This is where we see the real change from, let's say, 10 years to today. We could build this today. We could not have done that 10 years ago. And we can sell this fairly cheap to people in Ukraine. So they can start seeing, okay, we can sell here, we can sell there, this is the price. And I think we are just one of many. We specialize in grains and freight, but there's, I think you had this guy on from Sparta, which specialized in oil. I think they do exactly the same. And I think you will see people doing it in insurance as well. You will see people doing it in various forms of business where they say, hey, don't have 10 people doing 10 different stuff. Buy a platform, get 8 parts of the solution here, and then you can set the 2 super traders and make decisions on that.
Yeah, fascinating. Just one thing. You mentioned earlier on this sort of, it's price per ton, but the FFA is a price per day, right?
Yeah, excellent. Excellent noticed. FFA is traded in dollar per day. That means that if you are a freight buyer, you need to convert all your risk into a daily basis, or a daily risk, which, you know, doesn't really make a lot of sense. Because let's say you're shipping from, now I'm just throwing something at you, you're shipping from Rotterdam to Shanghai, 50,000 tons in whatever August month. You want to have that risk covered. You go out to the market. You could buy physical rate from a guy, but it comes with fairly restrictive requirements. He gives you a price. Okay, it's fine and dandy. But you prefer the financial hedge because what if you have to wash out, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But you can only get a dollar per day risk. And where? How do you calculate that? Is it a 60-day trip? Is it a 70-day trip? What if you find a ship that sails a bit faster? Is it a 48-day trip? So you suddenly have to sit as someone who is not in the freight market and sit and convert all of this risk into something else. This is very cumbersome. And this is also what I think had meant that a lot of people found it easier to deal with the ABCDs of trading, to say, okay, you deal with that, I just sell you FOB. Now, as I mentioned, this disintermediation is ongoing, and these FOB sellers are being forced onto global markets, having to manage that themselves. They can, of course, start the FFA trading. They can hire freight guys. But if there's not enough freight talent, if they're not really familiar or don't like having a dollar per day risk, what do they have left? Well, not to do too much marketing, but that's sort of the problem we're trying to solve here. And Sparta as well. So I think a lot of people can suddenly be active in a market with a lower, let's say, entry barrier than 10 years ago.
Yeah. Fascinating. Well, I'll put links to your organization in the show notes. It's been I've just about managed to cling on. It's been a fascinating discussion, and I hope we can have you back on in the future and pick up the threads of these key trends that are going on. And it's fascinating as well. I do find it fascinating. You've got all of the different commodity verticals essentially trying to solve the same challenges. Some are further along by nature of the markets that they're in, how hedgeable they are, to use sort of a prosaic phrase. But it's fascinating to see sort of, yeah, all these trends interweaving, and you've in the same time build us up a really nice picture of what goes on in the dry freight world.
Yeah, it is a fascinating place to be. I must say that it's really like you feel at the intersection of everything. When COVID hit, you know, freight was, you know, you were the center of the universe suddenly. Everyone was calling you. Everyone in your family was like, oh, what is this? Why can't we get our flat screens from China? And you try to explain, okay, I do more in like bulk commodities, but okay, you know, it's the same dynamic. And I think going forward, freight will matter more because it becomes more volatile. And I think if we take the last couple of years as an example, it suddenly is also something that's back on the radar for a lot of commodity companies. Whereas, you know, the last 10 years before COVID, they were probably like, we just buy freight, move on with life. Now it's actually a risk you have to manage and you have to think about it. Because one thing is that you didn't, even if you're still buying and even if you feel you're on the safe side, the people you are in bed with are still, you know, only as good as how well they perform. Counterparty risk is probably one of the biggest risks in shipping because it's global. You have people in Dubai, India, Denmark, Switzerland, everywhere. So it's very, the jurisdiction is all over the place. So you need not only a good knowledge, but you also need good lawyers.
And that is interesting, actually, because we've got to wrap it up. But those, when as HC, we built those first trading freight desks, you know, that was 10 years ago or more or so. And actually, you know, when we saw that first wave of geopolitical volatility, you know, the Arab Spring and so forth. And then, as you say, it kind of calmed down for a bit. But actually, it was those desks absolutely were part of the magic for many of these trading houses that had them over the last 3 years. And I'm sure we're going to see more look to build them. And in fact, we already are. So
I have a question for you, Paul. Before we wrap it up, I have a question for you. What do you think will change the most within the freight talent market in 10 years?
Well, I think you've identified the threads, right? I think that ultimately, in a world where it is short talent, and this is true globally, people are going to have to lean on technology to some extent to fill those gaps, right? So I think you are going to see the nature of roles change and the number of people needed change as well. To you've identified those couple of super traders who sit over and above the systems and are managing four events. I also think and hope as well that, you know, unfortunately, it's part of the nature of the boom-bust cycle of commodities, but we are starting to see organizations reinvest in talent. This sounds like a setup, but I didn't know you were going to ask this question, but certainly build graduate programs that hopefully means we're going to have more juniors coming through. I think the final thing as well is I think you're seeing more organizations willing to say, hey, we've actually got a really great wet freight person here. Oh, you know, we trust and believe that person can transfer into dry, right? Because it's the same sort of mentality. They're a proven trader, etc. And we can teach them the background and we've got the systems there to support decision making. So I think you are going to see more cross-fertilization.
I think you're right in that. And I think also one thing that's maybe changing a bit is the way people perceive their jobs. Because, for example, here in Denmark, working for Maersk is like working for, Wall Street in the USA. And if you're a commodity trader in Switzerland, that's like the coolest job. But I think a lot more people is becoming open to doing other stuff than what's, you know, on the normal agenda. I definitely seen here in Denmark, but also in my time in Switzerland, that freight trading, especially in Switzerland, went from being like, okay, that's what you do if you cannot become a real commodity trader, to becoming something like, okay, this is pretty cool. Because it feels a bit like what commodities.
Where the risk has moved to, yeah. Right? That's where the risk has moved to. I mean, that, you know, traders follow the opportunity. And frankly, if you've got highly transparent, highly disintermediated markets on the actual products themselves, which we're seeing in oil, right? There's outside events. Well, in ags, I think is the most biggest example of this. For the most part, ags trading doesn't make money unless there's big events. Right, we saw that in the last decade. Stable markets, it's so efficient, it's hard to make money. But if that risk is migrating to freight as a function of deglobalization and the energy transition and digitization, so we go on about all the time, then that's where the opportunity comes from. But anyway, got to wrap it up. It was a fantastic discussion. Look forward to having you on again in the future.
Yeah, thank you very much. And you are actually quite knowledgeable about freight, Paul.
I read your show notes. All right. Thanks.
No, thank you very much for having me. And have a nice weekend when Zane comes around.
Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode and want to support the show, please give us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify.
To find out more about HC Insider and HC Group, a search and advisory firm dedicated to the commodity markets, visit our website at www.hcgroup.global. There you can find out more about our services and our offices around the world. There you can also find more content, from interviews to insight pieces to more podcasts focused on the commodity value chains. Thanks again for listening.